Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On February 8, 1996, the Republican Congress passed and former President Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act. Fairness and accuracy in reporting, said the act, which opened the floodgates for media mergers, was, quote, bought and paid for by corporate media lobbies, end quote. In 1983, 50 companies controlled 90% of the media. Today, just 6 companies control 90% of the media. On today's Your Call, we are talking about the legacy of the Telecom Act. How has it affected coverage of issues like money in politics, local governments, the end of media outlets like Al Jazeera and KGO, and actions like Democracy Spring? Did you hear about this? Following a 10-day, 140-mile march from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., thousands of people gathered in D.C. this week to demand Congress take action to end the corruption of big money in politics and ensure free and fair elections. On Monday, over 400 people were arrested. On Tuesday, 85 people, mostly elderly people, were arrested. According to The Intercept, on Monday, during daytime and afternoon segments, CNN did not devote any coverage to the actions. MSNBC mentioned the protests for about 12 seconds. Fox mentioned the arrests and discussed the protests for 17 seconds. So joining me to talk about the Telecommunications Act and how it has affected media coverage are three guests. Tim Redmond is founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online paper featuring news, analysis, investigative reporting, arts and culture. Tim is also former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. And next Thursday, April 21st, 48 Hills is celebrating 3 years of independent journalism. The event, the party, will be at the Starlight Room atop the Sir Francis Drake Hotel in downtown San Francisco from 6 to 9 o'clock. And find more information at yourcallradio.org. And Tim Redmond joins me in studio. Hi, Tim. Thanks for coming
in. Hi, happy to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Tim Carr. He's campaign director for Free Press, an organization that fights to curb runaway media consolidation, protect press freedom, and ensure diverse voices are represented in the media. Tim also critiques, analyzes, and reports on the media for the Huffington Post and on his own blog, Media Citizen. And Tim joins us from D.C. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. Leslie Savin writes about politics and media, focusing on television advertising and popular language. Leslie was a 3-time Pulitzer Prize finalist in criticism for her Village Voice column about advertising and commercial culture. And she's got a piece in The Nation called Farewell to Al Jazeera America. The end of the media empire's U.S. venture does not bode well for American viewers or for journalism. And Leslie joins us from New York. Hi, Leslie. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to have you.
Good to be here.
So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Tim, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we're talking about the consolidation of giant media and the 6 corporations that control most of the major media and all of these big national stories that are being ignored. What I was impressed by this week was actually something completely on the opposite end of the spectrum. As you know, Rose, there was a police shooting of a homeless man in the Mission District in San Francisco. And actually, the best coverage I saw of this was a local online publication called Mission Local, which is a relatively small operation based in the Mission District in San Francisco. But they had 3 reporters on this. They were out there on the street. Almost immediately after the shooting, they interviewed witnesses, they rounded up people who the police hadn't talked to, and while, you know, everybody, you know, it's a shooting, so everybody was on it, I really think the folks at Mission Local, as I say, it's a small local operation, did a way better job than the major media.
And so what did they uncover that major media didn't?
Well, as I say, they were out there on the street almost immediately, and they had 3 different reporters talking to witnesses, and they quickly found that there were a number of witnesses. The police chief says that the homeless man had a knife and charged at the officers with the knife, and they had no choice but to shoot him. Numerous witnesses the mission local talked to immediately said that's not what happened at all, that the guy never charged the officers, that he was on the ground, that he never wielded the knife at them, and told a very, very different story. They also found a person who had posted on a another online neighborhood site and said he'd watched the entire thing out his window and that the person was lying on the ground the entire time. So very different story from what the police told. And as I say, it's good to see local reporters out there doing the job that local reporters ought to be doing, which is out on the streets finding people and finding information. So I think they beat the Chronicle. They beat us, me, 48 Hills. Hmm. They beat everybody in town on this, and I think they did a great job and they deserve credit.
So kudos to Mission Local for its coverage of the man who was shot multiple times by San Francisco police. And we will talk about Mission Local later in the show when we talk about local coverage, because a lot of people say the Telecom Act has been devastating when it comes to media consolidation, but now we have all of these new media ventures out there, like yours, Tim, and like right. Mission Local.
Right.
So we'll talk about the role that they play in right. this environment. That is Tim Redman. He's founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online newspaper. And what about you, Tim? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'd like to give a shout-out to a media analyst by the name of Andrew Tindall. Andrew Tindall does something called the Tindall Report. He watches the network newscasts every night, and he does a tally of the minutes that they devote to stories. And he's been covering their coverage of Donald Trump, presidential candidate, by comparison to all of the other presidential candidates out there. And he's part of, I think, a new wave, a sort of dawning realization, even among some of the media executives out there, that they have just devoted far too much time to one candidate. Obvious people who can guess who that is, at the expense of all others. So while there has been a lot of grumbling about this over the last 3 to 6 months, Andrew Tindall has been doggedly documenting it, and he has the data. He has the data that shows, yes, indeed, if you take the times devoted to covering Trump, if you take the number of mentions of his name on the national network news shows, he's mentioned more than all of the other candidates combined. And this sort of drumbeat of data coming from the Tindall Report has finally, I think, broken through, where you're seeing, hopefully, a broader realization that this is indeed a problem, that the role that the media has played in fanning, you know, some of the popular sentiments and around Trump has been as posed a potential threat to our democratic process.
Yeah, and we'll definitely talk about this also on today's show, because the New York Times conducted a study and it found that Donald Trump has earned close to $2 billion worth of free media attention during this campaign. And we've had a number of authors on Your Call in the last few weeks who have told us that when their publicists call up the cable shows to try to get them bookings, they are blatantly told it's all Trump all the time. And in some cases, their appearances have been canceled because Donald Trump is having a press conference. So they can't even get their attention, media attention, about their books about voting rights, about money and politics. And so we'll talk about that later in the show. Tim Carr is campaign director for Free Press. Thanks, Tim. What about you, Leslie? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, it's less something that was done well than a whole channel that was done well, and that was Al Jazeera America. It was done so well, it just stood heads and shoulders above other all-news cable channels, and yet it ended, what was it, on Wednesday, I believe, Tuesday night it ended. It's a long story about its rise and then about its sudden demise, which came to a surprise to most of the people working there. But it covered so much that we never see, that you might see in The Nation, for instance, where I work for, or on some many websites, or from what it sounds like on your station. But you rarely see that on television, and on television that had a national reach. As all the other channels were doing all Trump all the time, you could actually still realize that there was a refugee crisis throughout Europe and in Turkey and Syria. They did not just world news, but the pockets of news in America that got so little attention. They covered, for instance, the Flint lead in the water crisis, even before Rachel Maddow did. And she did a great job, and she did it intensely. But she, Al Jazeera, along, I believe, with AP, did it earlier. And that's the sort of thing they did. They had 12 bureaus in the United States, all over, and there was someone in Detroit on that, for instance. They had an amazing array, and they still do. You can still get the Al Jazeera America website, and you can see their old stories. It's just not being updated with anything new anymore. But, for instance, they had an Indian country vertical. That's what it was called, Indian country, which is all about Native Americans. That was so in-depth. There's nothing else like it in anything that is vaguely mainstream media. They had very specific stories about, for instance, Hawaiian natives who've been waiting since 1920 for promised land, or radio on the reservation. They just went in depth. One day I went, several days I was covering all the cable news channels, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, Al Jazeera America, and One American News, which is a conservative station. And in the time that CNN and MSNBC did almost exclusively politics and the election, in that time, Al Jazeera America did something on the refugee crisis as the Balkans are closing, the Turkish summit on the refugee crisis, dying languages in Nigeria and in America, and in African languages dying. They did Havana, they went to Cuba, they did tea growing in India. You just had a sense of the world out there. And now we have a very, in America, with our limited media, we have a very closed sense of the world. It's very narrow, which plays very well into campaigns like Trump's or Ted Cruz's, because if we don't know there's really a refugee crisis, or we don't know those people as people, but just as numbers and something that is a big deal one week and then disappears the next week, it's very easy for us to say wall them off or refuse them. So this narrowing of vision has a lot to do with where we are now politically.
And Leslie, you report that the Al Jazeera America staff were stunned when they found out it was shutting down on January 13th. They laid off about 700 people across 12 bureaus. Can you talk about what happened with Al Jazeera? I mean, I remember just an anecdote. My mom is one of those people who relies on TV for most of her news, and she would complain a lot about the morning shows, saying it's all Trump all the time. But when she found Al Jazeera, she said, I found this amazing station that covers all of these great issues. You have to check it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was in 2013, August 2013, Al Jazeera America was launched. And it was launched because Al Jazeera, well, let's back up even farther. In 1996, the country of Qatar, the wealthiest country per capita in the world, started Al Jazeera, a satellite, pan-Arab satellite channel that went across all Arab-speaking countries. And it was one of the first times, if not the first time, that there was really high professional standards and real reporting, investigations, and that they had the technology to spread it around. Then in, I forget the year, but I guess it was 2006, then they expanded to Al Jazeera English, which was covered the same areas plus more for the English-speaking population of the world, basically. Except in America, a lot of cable channels, Time Warner and Comcast, I'm not sure about each one, they refused to carry Al Jazeera English. You could get it online. You could maybe, if you were, I don't even know if you could stream it, but you might have been able to stream it, but you couldn't see it, really. The reason was obvious bias against anything that had an exotic Arabic-sounding name like Al Jazeera, which simply means peninsula, which is what Qatar is, right across from the Iran. It's a Gulf nation in that right there. Anyway, Al Jazeera, if you remember, during when Bin Laden was still alive, he was sending out videotapes of, you know, to show to threaten and to taunt America and so forth, and they were funneled through Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera received them, as far as I know, and as far as anybody knows, anonymously. They didn't have ties to the people in Al Qaeda at the time, but they it was a scoop for them, as any most channels would take such a scoop, and so they aired it, and so that gave in America that a lot of people just associated Al Jazeera with Bin Laden and Al Qaeda, and so Al Jazeera English couldn't get on. So in 2013, they devised Al Jazeera America, which was staffed all by almost exclusively with Americans, with seasoned, well-known, familiar faces on television, like John Siegenthaler, who was from NBC, Randall Pinkston, who was from did 33 years at CBS, Ray Suarez, who was on PBS. So there were familiar faces, trusted names, you know, nothing vaguely biased toward Muslim countries or anything like that. And in fact, these people covered all the controversies.
And Leslie, we'll dive into this a little later in the show, but I wanted to really switch gears and talk about the Telecommunications Act and kind of give the bigger picture story here. That's Leslie Savin. She writes about media issues, and she wrote about the closure of Al Jazeera America. So let's talk about the Telecommunications Act. On February 8th, 1996, the Republican Congress passed the Telecom Act, and former President Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting said that the act was bought and paid for by corporate media lobbies. And let's go back in time to find out why Bill Clinton actually signed this act. Here he is at the signing ceremony.
This law is truly revolutionary legislation that will bring the future to our doorstep. This historic legislation, in my way of thinking, really embodies what we ought to be about as a country and what we ought to be about in this city. It will provide for more information and more entertainment to virtually every American home. It embodies our best values by supporting the kind of market reforms that the Vice President mentioned. But this revolution has been held back by outdated laws designed for a time when there was one phone company, three TV networks, no such thing as a personal computer. Today, with the stroke of a pen, our laws will catch up with our future. We will help to create an open marketplace where competition and innovation can move as quick as light. Thank you.
And that is Bill Clinton at the signing ceremony for the Telecommunications Act. Back then, we heard a lot about competition. In 1983, 50 companies controlled 90% of the media. Today, that number is just 6. And Tim Carr, can you talk about what the Telecommunications Act was supposed to do? It was the first major reform of telecom policy since 1934. What were the key changes?
Well, they recognized that we were entering a digital era, that the computer, that the internet were growing, and that they needed to change the legislative structure, the statutory structure, to keep pace with those changes. And so one of the things that, interestingly, President Clinton said at the time was that the Communications Act would also protect consumers against monopolies. But if you look at some of the things that the act did, it lifted the limit on the number of radio stations a single company could own. At that time, the limit was set at 40 stations. And as when that was taken away, it paved the way for a company like Clear Channel, which at one point, Clear Channel is now called iHeartMedia. They had a rebranding exercise about a year and a half ago. But at one point they owned 1,200 stations, so 40 to 1,200. It also listed the number of local TV stations that a company could a single company could own. They used to have a cap that said that your station network could only reach 25% of U.S. TV households. The act itself raised that number to 35%. which was then subsequently loosened even further. And one of the problems with the Communications Act, and some of it, on the digital side, some of the language put in place to govern the future of the internet was pretty good. They were really, the net neutrality battle that we're engaged in, and won't go into too much detail on this call, but the battle over protecting the open internet, which has been one of the defining media policy battles of the last 10 years, was really built on language that was in the act that was stripped out by a Republican administration and a Republican FCC under then Chairman Michael Powell. So one of the problems with the act is that it actually ran headlong into the Bush administration, and the Bush administration FCC chair Michael Powell, who sought to further loosen some of these limits and allow for the kind of unleashed media consolidation that ended up with companies like Clear Channel owning up to 1,200 stations, that ended up with a company like News Corp, which owns Fox News Channel, but also a number of television stations across the country, owning, having reached in local stations to nearly half of the American viewing audience.
Tim, what would you add to this? I mean, the six companies are General Electric, News Corp, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and CBS. These are the major six companies that control about 90% of the media.
And let us remember that Time Warner also controls a significant part of the nation's cable infrastructure, right? Which is the other interesting twist on this, is not only do they own media outlets, they own the service that delivers them to you. We were talking about Al Jazeera America earlier. You know, if you have a couple, I mean, there aren't that many cable providers in most of the country. It's, it's Comcast, now known as Xfinity. It's Time Warner. It's a few others. If they decide, oh, we don't like Al Jazeera America, then people just don't get it on their TV. So that's, but the real key of what the Telecommunications Act did, and it was part of the first Clinton administration, Bill Clinton really liked this idea, was it was deregulating a previously regulated industry. It was basically saying that rather than the government representing the people of the United States saying that we need some control over how the news media, which is an extremely powerful force in our society, some control over how it operates, some guarantee that there will be a diversity of voices, we're going to let the free market decide that. And that was the key point he made in that clip. He said, well, now we're going to let the market decide. Right? And that worked really well, for example, with banking, didn't it? It worked, it's worked really well with the news media. We've seen the free market has led to tremendous consolidation and not to an increase in the number of voices and the diversity of what people get. So, but that was part of Clinton's whole approach. He did this. He deregulated industries right and left even before the Bush administration got in.
And when we talk about the passage of the Telecom Act, only 3% of Congress voted against the bill. Five senators and 16 members of the House, including then Representative Bernie Sanders, voted against the Telecommunications Act. We often hear about how it affected television. But after the break, I would also like to talk about how it affected the newspaper industry. I know you follow that very closely, Tim. And then we'll also talk about how it affected the radio industry. And just over the last few weeks, the entire newsroom of KGO, which is owned by Cumulus, were fired. And so we have some information about radio also. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are talking about the Telecommunications Act, the legacy of this act. Back in 1983, 50 companies controlled 90% of the media. Today, that number is just six. We're joined by Tim Redmond, founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online newspaper, Tim Carr, campaign director for Free Press, and Leslie Savin. She writes about the media, focusing on television and advertising. This is your call. We'll be back after this.
This is your call on Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you'd like to add to today's discussion or a question that you think needs to be asked, please join our conversation by calling toll-free 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Inflection Point with your host, Laura Schiller. And then at noon today, it's the Tavis Smiley Show here on KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with two of the six environmental activists who have won this year's Goldman Environmental Prize. These environmental warriors work against all odds to protect the environment and their communities. So how are environmental justice activists changing their communities for the better? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable. We are talking about the legacy of the Telecom Act 20 years after it was signed by former President Bill Clinton. Back in 1983, 50 companies controlled 90% of the media. Today, that number is just six. So what questions do you have about the Telecom Act and how it's affected coverage of things like money and politics, the end of outlets like Al Jazeera and KGO, and actions like Democracy Spring? I'd love to know if you've even heard about Democracy Spring. I know at least two of our guests today have not. We're joined by Tim Redman, founder of 48 Hills. 48 Hills is celebrating 3 years of independent journalism at the Starlight Room atop the Sir Francis Drake in downtown San Francisco on Thursday, April 21st from 6 to 9.
And you are all welcome to come.
Yes, and you can find information at 48hills.org. Tim Carr is campaign director for Free Press, and Leslie Savin writes about politics and the media, and she wrote in The Nation about the end of Al Jazeera America. Tim Redmond, we often talk about television and cable. How did the Telecom Act affect the newspaper industry?
Well, the newspaper industry, of course, as we know, is reeling from a lot of changes in the marketplace. But, you know, one of the things that I think the Telecommunications Act did is when Clinton said we're opening this to the free market, I think there was a change in everyone's attitude in big media away from the idea that operating a big media outlet was some kind of a sacred responsibility of public trust, that you had a responsibility to do certain things, into the idea that this was nothing but a marketplace where we were out to make money. You know, when I started in this business a long time ago, Rose, when I first worked for the Daily Newspaper in 1978 in Hartford, Connecticut, I worked for the Hartford Courant. And the Hartford Courant was at that point still an independently owned newspaper that obviously made a lot of money. But the Hartford Courant assigned a reporter to cover every little tiny town in northern Connecticut. If there were, you know, if there was a town of, 1,000 people, they had a full-time reporter going to every city council meeting, to every planning board meeting, to every school board meeting. And they could have made just as much money as they did without actually doing all of that. They had a monopoly on northern Connecticut. But there was this idea that it was our responsibility as a newspaper to cover all the news wherever it was, whether it was profitable or not. Right? And that idea vanished with the Telecommunications Act, which basically, as you know, as Clinton said there, basically said, now we're opening this up to the free market. We're no longer regulating news media. And I think all of the media outlets got the message that, okay, this is all about making money. And it's all about making a lot of money. And I think that's when you saw the gradual decline in this idea of news media, including newspapers, as a sacred trust that, you know, you have to cover what's going on at City Hall. You have to cover what's going on at the school board. You know, we used to publish the school lunch menu, right? You just had to do it because there was no place else to get it, right? And that kind of went away. Now, you combine that with the marketplace changes and, of course, the rise of online news and all of the other things that have happened, the loss of advertising base that's happened to daily newspapers. And there are so few daily newspapers now that actually act as if they have a responsibility to cover news even when it is not profitable.
And Leslie, you write extensively about these issues. What do you see as some of the most significant consequences of the Telecommunications Act, particularly when you look at the issues that are covered or not covered?
Well, as Tim was saying, there is a large exodus away from local news and covering that in detail and getting the more general based out of nowhere sort of news that in fact could be written by and has been in some cases by bots, believe it or not.
By bots?
Yes.
Can you explain that?
There has been, and I don't have the details right here or in my mind, but there is some news that is actually written by robots that is, you know, they put together the most salient phrases or words or places, and they extract some news. And I think there is a news service that allow, you know, that then spreads this out. And of course, you don't have to pay reporters for that. In a similar case, and this was in Southern California, I believe, there was, to cover these council meetings and local news, like Tim was talking about, it was too expensive to hire reporters, and they actually outsourced that to another people in another country, and it might have been India.
It was India. Yeah.
It was okay. There you go. And it was a camera that would show the meeting.
What happened is they would have reporters in India watch the city council meetings on TV through the camera feed, and then write what happened and send it in, so that the actual coverage of your local city council was happening half a world away.
Yeah.
And the reporters were actually never there.
Yep. I mean, that's beyond sad. This is the big corporations that own all of these things do not care. And also what Tim was saying, you know, money became the overriding concern. Money's always been a concern, but not as it has been. And newspapers all over the country, the big ones, had to show a profit margin that other industries didn't always have to have. And if they didn't have that high profit margin, there were layoffs, there was, you know, cost cutting. Everybody, I know a lot of writers and reporters, they've almost all been laid off from somewhere at this point. And those high profit margins became sacred.
Let's also talk about radio. Tim Carr, here in the Bay Area, KGO, which is a Bay Area institution. I mean, a lot of people rely on KGO on their long commutes. And over the last few months, the entire newsroom was fired, along with KFOG, a local rock station. And Cumulus owns KGO and KFOG. And I have reporter friends at KGO who said exactly what Leslie is saying, that when they came in, they really didn't know much about news, and it was very clear that it was all about profit. And Cumulus was founded by Lou Dickey in 1997. He purchased Citadel Broadcasting, and now Cumulus is a radio giant, 460 stations in 90 radio markets. They're the second largest radio group owner, second only to iHeartMedia. That was Clear Channel. They changed their name to iHeartMedia in 2014, and they own 840 radio stations. Now you turn on KGO, and you're getting these hot talk guys from Sacramento who really don't know much about the Bay Area in the morning. So, Tim, what are your thoughts about radio consolidation?
Well, what happened as a result of the 1996 Act is not only that it increased the sort of horizontal consolidation, which is where you have, you know, a TV station owner buying up several TV stations because they lifted the ownership cap, but you also had vertical integration, where you had a company like News Corp, for example, that not only owned television stations, it also owned newspapers, it also owned cable television stations. There were cross-ownership rules that were eased as a result of the cap that allowed that, and that included radio stations. So when you have, you know, there's a word that you often heard in the era of broadcast consolidation, I would say that we're now in the era of broadband consolidation, which I'd like to talk a little bit about later. But in the era of broadcast consolidation, there was a word popular among many of these executives. It was called synergy. And the thought was that if you have several newspapers, if you have several radio stations, if you have several television and cable channel stations, that, you know, you didn't need to create one type of content for each of those industries. Unique type of content for each of the industries. You just had one piece of content that could be then synergized across all of those industries. Of course, now when you have one person writing a news story that appears in your radio outlet, that appears in your television outlet, that appears in your newspaper, the thought being among these executives that you don't need to have a reporter covering that same topic in each of those outlets. So this kind of synergies that are a result of vertical consolidation, another outcome of the act, resulted in the types of layoffs that you're seeing today and that we've been seeing for more than 10 years now.
Tim Redman, what does the loss of KGO mean for the Bay Area and Northern California?
Well, it's the loss of a major news outlet. And, you know, KGO did what radio news is supposed to do. They covered what was going on, everything from, you know, crime reports to traffic to accidents to what was going on at City Hall. They had reporters around with mics everywhere. And they actually, as I say, they actually covered the news. And that's a big loss because there are fewer and fewer of these major outlets, particularly radio, that are actually covering news like this. I mean, it was, you know, people can argue about whether they did the best at this or the best at that. But the fact is, they had a team of reporters out there covering news. And lots of people listened to it on the radio and found out more information about what was going on. So it's a huge loss. It's a huge loss. It's another source of basic local information. That's the other thing is, they were talking about what's going on in your community, on your streets, what's going, you know, on your freeways. And, you know, you replace that with these talk radio folks who are talking about what's going on nationally, what's going on statewide.
They were talking about infidelity yesterday at 8:30 a.m.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, that's fine if you're into that sort of thing at 8:30 a.m. I'm a little tired at 8:30 a.m. But the point is, you're not finding out what's going on in your community.
Right.
You're not finding out about the police shooting down the block. You're not finding out about the traffic jam that's going to keep you from getting to work. You're not finding out about whether the trains and the buses are running on schedule. You're not finding out about what the mayor is doing that day. That's the kind of thing that we're missing.
Tim Redman is founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online paper. Next Thursday, the 21st, 48 Hills is celebrating 3 years of independent journalism at the Sir Francis Drake Hotel, Starlight Room, from 6 to 9. Tim Carr is campaign director for Free Press, and Leslie Savin writes about politics and media. She wrote about the closure of Al Jazeera America for The Nation magazine. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Morning, Rose and guests. You know, I actually have some good news, although it may be kind of difficult to get it to come to use in this campaign year. The big ugly company Clear Channel is, and they've changed their name to iHeart, they're $21 billion in debt, and they're supposed to pay $6 billion within something like 60 days that started a week or few ago. So, The whole idea that these media giants are actually failures, and you know, if you look at KGO, you've just been talking about them. That's Cumulus, and they also are. I think they're second to Clear Channel.
Right.
And if they're not financially able to provide a news staff. I worked in radio in a bunch of small markets like Colorado, a bunch of small towns and places like that. And it used to be in a bad economy that the local radio station could barter ads and that they could actually stimulate the economy by barter. And, you know, the grocery store would give them a couple of hundred bucks worth of free groceries to the staff. They have the car dealership would barter a car for the radio station for ads, things like that. Well, now with the corporate chains, they've even fired the local ad salesman. And so all of the ad buys are done in the corporate headquarters. The money is sucked to the corporate headquarters right away, and the local economy is basically treated like a colony. And I would bet that a lot of major cities are being treated like colonies as well at this point. You played that Clinton clip. One of the horrible things about that was that they allowed 8 stations per corporation to be owned in the same city. 8 stations, so we've got 8 different clear channels in San Francisco Bay Area. We've got 8 different cumulus.
Well, thank you for calling in. You know, there was a great story about this at Truthout, and I'm just looking for the author's name, Michael Corcoran, and he wrote that this issue has not been central in the 2016 presidential election, but it is deeply concerning that of all the presidential candidates, the big media lobby has chosen to back Hillary Clinton. Media industry giants have donated way more money to her than any other candidate in the race, according to data from the Center for Responsive Politics. He writes, in light of this, we must be mindful of the media reform challenges we face in the present as we try to prevent the type of damage to our democracy that was caused by the passing of the Telecommunications Act. Tim Carr, what are your thoughts on that? It's not getting any attention in the election.
Well, it's not, and money in politics more generally doesn't get a lot of coverage from television stations, from mainstream media outlets, because money in politics, and we often talk about where the money's coming from, you know, there's a mystery about all these dark money forces that support super PACs and these other sort of elusive 501c4s, but we don't often hear a lot about where that money goes, and an overwhelming majority of it, to the tune of billions of dollars in a general election year, ends up in the bank accounts of broadcast companies. Broadcast television ads, political ads, are still seen as one of the more effective ways for a candidate either to promote his or herself or attack his or her opponent. And so a lot of this money ends up in the bank accounts of these broadcasters, radio, television. And I did a study in 2012 where I went into battleground states and I looked at the television stations that were operating there. I looked at the political ads that they are running and tallied the amount of political ads. I looked at the money they were taking in for those political ads. And then I compared that to the amount of time the local television stations were devoting to coverage of those political ads. Were they doing any fact-checking? You know, a lot of these political ads are grossly inaccurate. Were the local television stations that were airing these ads devoting time in their local newscasts to fact-check those, to cover them, to look at the sources of money behind these political advertisements? And I found with very, very few exceptions that none of them were. Now you can surmise from that it's not in their interest, obviously, to expose or to bite the hands that is feeding them billions of dollars every 4 years.
That is Tim Carr. He's campaign director for Free Press. Leslie Savin writes about politics and the media. And Tim Redmond is founder of 48 Hills. On today's Media Roundtable, we are talking about the legacy of the 1996 Telecommunications Act. In 1983, 50 companies controlled 90% of the media. Today, that number is just 6. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Armand writes in, I remember a story from a long time ago. In the Midwest, there was a robot radio station with no staff. When a huge fire broke out and the people called the station to put out an alert, there was no one to answer the phone.
Yeah, I remember that story too. There was a natural disaster and nobody was able to get the TV station to put out the news because it was all being run by robots. And that's kind of a scary thing. I mean, again, it's that responsibility that broadcasters and newspapers used to feel like they had to be part of the community. Yeah, there was nobody, there wasn't a station manager, there wasn't a sales rep, there wasn't a DJ, there was no one there.
Yeah, it was Minot, North Dakota. There were train wreck, toxic fumes in the air. In fact, someone died as a result of those fumes because they couldn't get the alert out over the local radio station in time. The door was locked. They actually sent emergency crews to the radio station to try to open the door to put out a local emergency alert, and they couldn't even get into the station because no one was there.
Tim Carr, you brought up money in politics. You're in Washington, right?
I'm actually based in New York, but we have offices in Washington.
Okay, so have you heard about Democracy Spring?
I have, yes.
Okay.
In fact, I've had a few friends who've been arrested down in Washington
and
as they've been protesting for campaign finance reform.
And Tim Redmond and Leslie, you have not, right?
I have seen nothing in the news media about Democracy Spring at all, and I actually kind of pay attention to the news media.
Leslie?
Now that you've told me what it was. I did see a flash of some people getting arrested, and I don't recall where it was. And then I looked it up, and CNN online covered it.
Right.
But I don't know if they did on television.
Right. Yeah,
I mean, the only way that I had heard about it was that through social media, friends on social media were posting photographs of themselves being arrested. But you know, social media can't always pick up the slack for the mainstream news outlets.
Well, let's talk about how the Telecom Act affects coverage of actions like this. So a lot of people were marching from the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia to D.C. It's a 140-mile march. Thousands gathered in D.C. on Monday, and they're demanding Congress take action to end the corruption of money in politics. They're also demanding free and fair elections. On Monday, over 400 people were arrested. According to reports, the police vans were so packed they had to stop arresting people. On Tuesday, 85 people were arrested, mostly older people. According to Rolling Stone, police records suggest that the arrests were the largest in at least a decade. Close observers of activism say it may have been the largest since the Vietnam War. And according to The Intercept, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, they dedicated seconds to this. I did notice that the AP, the Washington Post, MSNBC, and CNN had short articles online. So, Tim, how does consolidation affect coverage of actions like this?
Well, if you had more independent media outlets and you actually had more reporters on the streets trying to cover these things, you'd hear more news. I mean, that's the reality right there. If you had more people covering the news and you had more people scrambling to get their word out and to get their side of it out, I mean, you know, the flip side of this is, and, you know, the good news, if there is any, is that, you know, in cities like San Francisco, we're starting to see lots of new, smaller digital-only ventures. And, you know, when we had this police shooting, as I say, you actually saw from several different local outlets, reporters out on the streets trying to get the scoop and try to get the story out. You didn't see that in Washington, D.C. with this, and you didn't see it on the national news, in part because it's all Trump all the time. And I think you're right that you know, the broadcast clickbait, so to speak, of putting Trump on all the time is what they're doing. But it's also, you just don't have enough reporters and enough staff and enough outlets. There used to be many more media outlets that would try to cover this.
Tim Carr, people say, look, we've got ProPublica, we've got the Center for Investigative Reporting. There are so many new ventures out there. Do you think that they can make up what we have lost from media consolidation?
I don't think that there is a short-term silver bullet. And, you know, you're looking at tens of thousands of jobs, not just reporters in newsrooms, but the staff, the editors, who support reporters. That model, there's oftentimes when we have these sorts of discussions amongst journalists that there's this kind of nostalgia for the good old days when everybody who was working in journalism could find a job. We're not going to go back to the good old days, and frankly, I'm not sure that they were as good as sometimes we think they are. But we need to find new models. We need to find new models that will employ all of these students who are coming out of journalism schools. Journalism schools are still very heavily subscribed. You know, young people want to become journalists. It's a noble profession. And so we at Free Press are actively looking at new models, whether there are ways that we can find new sources of funding for non-commercial or public outlets. There's some promising ideas out there, one of which is looking at spectrum sale. Right now, the phone and cable companies or the wireless carriers are spending billions and billions of dollars for new spectrum because they want to expand wireless networks, and there's some opportunity for some of that spectrum, a lot of which is owned by public television stations in states like New Jersey, which is one of the places we're looking at. If the sale back of that spectrum, there's an incentive, something called an incentive auction that's happening over the next year. If the sale back of that spectrum, if you can take money out of that to put in a local trust fund that would support local non-commercial journalism, you could actually raise a significant amount of money that would actually be competitive with the amount of money we already paid for public broadcasting outlets.
And Leslie, just quickly, what do you think about the new media companies?
Well, it is great that they're doing it, and it is often very, it's noble. And what Tim was just saying about buying back public airwaves in New Jersey. I'm calling you, talking to you from New Jersey, and believe me, we need that. But what I wanted to say also, when we were talking about how media companies are making so much money from this election because of all the ads that are being bought on them, and so they have an incentive to run the ads even not in advertising time. One of the most amazing statements from anybody in media has come from Les Moonves, who is the CEO of CBS. And as you said, CBS is one of the six companies that is the big consolidators of other media. And you have the smaller, upstart media on one side, and then you have these giants on the other side that have been doing Trump all the time. And here's what he said just a couple months ago, and it was amazing, and reveals a lot about what we're talking about. He said, Donald Trump, by the way, hasn't been running that many ads, but the television companies make a lot of money off of him anyway because they can raise their ad rates for other ads because he brings ratings up. So Les Moonves said, I've never seen anything like this, and this is going to be a very good year for us. Sorry, it's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Keep going. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS.
Right.
And that's the sort of thing that smaller media companies are up against.
Yes, that speaks volumes, and we should say The Intercept broke that story, right?
Ah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to continue covering media consolidation and these issues. There's a lot of interest in this. Leslie Savin writes about these issues. Check out her piece, Farewell to Al Jazeera America at The Nation. Tim Carr is campaign director for Free Press. They fight to curb runaway consolidation. And Tim Redmond is founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online paper. Next Thursday, they're celebrating 3 years of independent journalism, the Starlight Room atop the Sir Francis Drake in downtown San Francisco from 6 to 9 o'clock. Leslie, Tim Carr, and Tim Redmond, thank you all for joining us.
So happy to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with two of the six environmental activists who have won this year's Goldman Environmental Prize. These environmental warriors work against all odds to protect the environment and their communities. They often work in countries where violence and death threats against defenders are on the rise. So how are environmental justice activists changing their communities for the better? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Aphoristic to the panoramic. This Friday on Music from Other Minds at 11 p.m.
Give your ears a weekly workout Saturday nights, 8 to midnight on Tangents. Your open ears will be treated to cross-pollinating, genre-bending, interconnective, omnitemporal, polymorphous, cross-fertilizing, tangential music radio. Saturday nights, 8 to midnight, on your local public radio, KALW, San Francisco.
Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, why does math have such a bad rap?
Unfortunately, school mathematics has become this sort of strange set of rituals that really is nothing like the maths of the world and nothing like the maths that mathematicians use.
And what's the secret to talking someone off the ledge?
We recently discovered that there are three kind of magic words: smart, brave, and proud.
Dr. Joe Bowler, professor of mathematics education at Stanford, and Nancy Lublin, the founder of Crisis Text Line. That's today on Inflection Point. Stay tuned.